Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey everybody, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Ben Holderness, and welcome to the Holderness Family Podcast. I'm going to try to make it through this episode without passing out from excitement and nervousness.
Ben has been throwing out the name Andy Weir for years in our house. He's had our children read his books. Andy Weir comes up, I would say, weekly as a writer, just his ideas, and it is an inspiration for Penn. So when Penn said, I'd like to interview Andy Weir on our podcast, and then he emailed back, the shriek that you heard, Penn works in the attic, so it's like, you know, floor number three is the attic. I was outside downstairs with the dog, and
you thought it was like an old lady who'd fallen down the stairs or something, right?
No, I mean, old ladies are tough, they're fine, they're not gonna scream like
I'm just
that.
Talking about the register.
Yes, yeah. The register was high, and it was as if your high school crush had texted you back.
Well, he kind of did, although not high school. Okay, let's back up. Andy Weir wrote The Martian. That's probably how most people would know that name. The Martian became this blockbuster hit, right?
With Matt Damon as the star.
Right. But on top of that, he's had access to NASA. He's had access to SpaceX.
And if you're a regular here, you know that Penn is a space nerd.
Right.
And I say nerd with love.
Oh,
this is the genre of books Penn likes to read. They want to make it. It's called hard science fiction.
Why do you always do that with the H when you use hard
science fiction? It's almost as if it's more. They're trying to make it sexy, you know. Anyway,
or embarrassing. I don't know. But here's what hard science fiction is. It's science fiction where there's a real sense of accountability on physics and on the feasibility of things. And so Andy sort of he's the best hard science fiction writer there is out there, because he adds humanity and hope and personality and character development to a real knowledge of orbital physics, which he's obviously taken enough time to learn about, to the point that he's in a documentary about Mars that Nat Geo put together. Like, he's being interviewed about this. So
can I ask you, we have yet to interview Andy. He's about to at any moment click into the Zoom meeting. So yes. Penn is a little anxious.
Yeah.
What is it about this author in particular? Because you have a very specific genre you like to read, but I wouldn't call you you read, but you're not somebody that can't, you know, he can't put a book down. But anything he publishes, you get so excited about. What is it about Andy that you find very inspiring, and why did you want to talk to him today?
Well, for starters, the way that I unwind when it comes to reading is escaping the world or anything normal. I don't normally read books about going to the beach and finding love, because I did that with my wife. I found love. That's why I want to read a book about something that I'll probably never be able to experience. So it'll take me on that journey. And that was the case. Like, Dune was my favorite book growing up. I loved Isaac Asimov growing up, which apparently Andy did as well. And I like to leave this earth if I can, or go into the future, or go somewhere that I'll never see when I'm reading a book. And so he checks that box with going to Mars, or in his most recent book, which I think might have been better than The Martian, going to the sun to try to save the Earth by assembling, Kim?
Penn loves a book where they assemble the best in their field.
Yeah, so assembling the best in their field. But on top of it, there is this crazy amount of self-awareness, self-deprecation, and humor that Andy puts into these very grave situations. I think it's what I use to deflect some levels of anxiety, definitely some levels of ADHD, and certainly any sort of trauma or sadness that I have in my life. And he does it, man. He does it, and he does it in a hopeful, happy way. And so I want to know this person who's writing. I've been fascinated by him because I don't think that we're just alike, but he has to have some of the traits that you and I have, Kim, which is a real self-awareness that our brain doesn't necessarily work like everybody else's. Does that make sense?
Yeah. He has talked openly about struggles with depression and anxiety, and you can sort of see that in the characters as well. I think we should cut to the interview at this point.
Absolutely.
But I am a little worried.
That?
Sometimes when we meet our heroes.
Oh, that he's going to be a dick?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Well.
I mean, what if?
Honestly, I'm still going to read his books. That's how good his books are.
Okay.
So I
just want you to be prepared.
Okay.
That not it's not all the time that we get to talk to somebody we admire so much. And if they let you down, I'm here for you, babe.
And I have a prediction.
Yeah.
I think that you are going to make a great connection with him.
I'm going to get his cell phone number. We're going to start texting.
I think, and it's not going to make me jealous. Like, I don't mind watching. It's like, I am totally fine with you making a connection with him, because I think one of the reasons that I'm so drawn to Andy is the same reason why I'm drawn to you.
Aww.
I think that you guys have a lot in common. I think that you...
Does he cry at the drop of a hat and get anxious for no reason?
You know, I don't know, but I do think that he has an energy about him, at least in his books. It's so funny. I've never met him.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, okay, so how about this?
Do you remember that book with the Nim's Island?
Yeah.
Where Jodie Foster is like, she writes about this adventure and then she's like a crazy agoraphobic.
Yeah.
Like, what if that happens?
I know. Do you want to read his official intro so people know who we're dealing with here?
You can read it with me, babe. Andy Weir is an American novelist and, you may not know, a former computer programmer. He was raised in California, the son of a physicist and an engineer. He got his first computer programming job at the age of 15 for Sandia. He also worked for AOL and Palm, and even worked on programming a Warcraft video game. Then he took to writing sci-fi, first on his website.
His first published novel, The Martian, was available for free on his website, but after fans implored him to make it available on Kindle, it was touted by the Wall Street Journal as the best pure sci-fi in years. It ultimately became a blockbuster movie starring Jessica Chastain and Matt Damon. His most recent book, Project Hail Mary, was another bestseller and is in development as a movie starring Ryan Gosling. Weir is married. His wife's name is Ashley. They met in Los Angeles while he was pitching a TV series. They have a son who's 2 years old, which should be very exciting to try to write with a 2-year-old. Welcome, Andy Weir.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We are so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. Penn is acting very chill right now. But well, I don't want you to realize what a stalker. No, he's not a stalker. No, I don't want to freak you out with what a big fan he is. So we're just gonna pretend this is totally normal.
I'm just gonna act like this is not a big deal.
Sure. I mean, it's not.
It's not a big deal.
If you're this impressed by like a Z-list celebrity, boy.
He's met some fancy people.
So if you were at the movie shoot with like Ryan Gosling and Matt Damon, I would completely ignore them. But like, that's all I'm going to say. Like, let's just we're going to move on.
Well, That's really sweet.
I am very impressed by you, but I may be just following Ryan Gosling around, but that's fine.
That seems reasonable. I mean, I would too, and I'm not even gay.
Everyone's a little bit gay.
We all have our limits. I mean,
yeah.
There's only so heterosexual you can be.
Right.
And I mean, we've all got our.
Yeah. And then when you're.
We talk about this actually on the podcast.
I think it's a spectrum. And I think Matt Damon and Ryan Gosling. And honestly, let's add Ryan Reynolds in there.
I don't know that he's attached to an Andy Weir book yet, but he could be.
Maybe he'll play Rocky. I'm
not convinced Ryan Reynolds and Ryan Gosling are different people.
They're both Canadian.
I mean, they're both Canadians. Yeah. They're both Ryan. They're both, you know, national treasures.
They are.
I don't know.
They are. You're a very prolific writer. You've done a lot of amazing things. But I am very curious. As a sci-fi writer, I just want to know, what is your theory about these UFOs and balloons we're seeing in the sky?
Well, the balloons are spy balloons. I mean,
right. Yes.
Pretty straightforward.
Those are spy balloons. But the other UFOs we're seeing.
I think they're just, you know, test aircraft or whatever else. I don't think they're aliens.
You don't? Oh,
I'm sorry to be boring.
Aww.
But I don't think that if aliens visited Earth, they would be so, like, circumspect, you know?
Mm-hmm. What would they do?
I'm not sure. It would depend on why they're here and their level of technology. There's a lot of schools of thought about it. The first school of thought is that, like, the aliens just wouldn't care because they're so far advanced beyond us, we're not worth their notice.
Yes.
Kind of like when you're, I think the analogy is, if you're building a freeway overpass somewhere, you don't stop and talk to the anthill.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So they just wouldn't care. Another approach that science fiction authors like to use is aliens would see us as sort of a Galapagos Islands kind of thing. It's like, ooh, this
studied.
Is a unique ecology.
Yes.
It's worth studying, but we need to not interfere with it or mess with it. Mm. You know, you got your prime directive style Star Trek aliens who are like, oh, okay, this society's primitive and we need to protect it from outside influence. And other than that, we need to stay and just let it develop naturally. That's a fun science fiction way of looking at things. But again, for aliens like that, you've got to imagine that their technology would be so far in excess of our own that they wouldn't accidentally get caught on shaky cell phone video, right?
And here's my thought. I mean, if we are going to be taken over by alien overlords.
Wow, you went straight to that.
Yep. I really went.
I
went.
I was
doomsday.
Talking about basically alien environmentalists.
No,
and you're like,
no. You're like,
hail reptars.
Yes. No, seriously. Right. But here's the thing. I have said this. I would like to just go first. I don't think I have the fight in me to survive an alien attack. I just don't feel like I should be taking up resources. So if the aliens overlords come, I just would like to be the first gone.
Just the first gone.
Yeah.
I myself would attempt to be a sympathizer.
Okay.
Ken Brockman.
Like, hail ants.
Yeah. Yes. I for one can be counted on to drag the fellow humans into your underground sugar caves to toil away. Yeah, I got you.
I for one welcome our new alien overlords.
He knows what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah. He quotes that very often.
Andy, why do you like writing about space?
I don't know. Why does anybody like anything? It's like space is my hobby, right?
Yeah.
Space. I'm a space dork. That's what I'm into. Mm-hmm. If I was a gearhead, I'd be writing about cars. If I was a gardener, I'd be writing about plants. But everybody has their hobbies, interests, and passions. And mine happens to be like spaceflight. Not so much astronomy, although I do think, you know, there's a lot of astronomy that I think is really cool. But like, so the natural bodies in space are cool. I think that's neat. But really, I like spaceships. You know, things that we built and sent into space, either with or without people aboard, whatever. That sort of stuff is just insanely cool to me. And
that's
what I read about.
Just to follow up, though, you're not just writing about space. You're writing about people and challenges and real drama up there. And you do have a gift for that. So I want to know where that comes from.
Well, it usually starts with the science. I start by thinking about, ooh, wouldn't it be cool, this scientific thing? And then stories develop from there. So, you know, for The Martian, my initial thought was like, how would we get humans to Mars and back?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I wasn't even thinking about this in terms of writing a story. I was just daydreaming. I'm like, how would we do, you know, a mission to Mars with our current technology or maybe some slight advances, you know, if that was like, if we're really putting or making it an objective. I don't like the home and transfer nonsense of like having to leave them there for like 18 months. What if you used ion engines? That way they have a lot more control over when they go, when they come, how long it takes to get there. They have abort options. I like that. Okay. Then how do we get them there? The whole largely invented by Robert Zubrin, Mars Direct approach of like send your launch vehicle in advance, have it slowly make its fuel out of Mars's atmosphere and solar power and so on. And so that whole mission profile I put together in my head, and I was like, oh, this is fun. This is the dorky sort of stuff I like to do. And then I'm like, well, what if this went wrong? The mission needs to account for that. Like, what if this goes wrong? How do they fix it? What if that goes wrong? If they have to abort, can they abort? Can they safely abort? And what if multiple things go wrong at once? And the kind of increasingly desperate things the crew would have to do to stay alive started to sound pretty interesting. And I was like, okay, well, what if I isolate an astronaut into that situation? I say, like, everybody thinks he's dead. They're left. He's gone. He's stranded there. That's a pretty interesting story. And then I had already created this whole, you know, mission architecture. And so that defined kind of the resources he had available. And for Artemis, also known as that other book Andy Weir wrote, because Project Hail Mary is really popular. The Martian's real popular. People often say, Andy Weir, author of The Martian and Project Hail Mary.
There was another one.
I liked Artemis. Oh, come on. Artemis was different. Artemis felt a little more punk.
It was, well, yeah, I've got stuff to say about that. But anyway, So for Artemis, I started out with the design of, like I said, what is humanity's first like permanent settlement, like a city that is not on Earth? What's it going to be like? That's where that speculation began. I'm like, is it going to be a city in orbit? Is it going to be on Mars? Is it going to be on the moon? Is it going to be in the asteroid belt? And I finally decided, well, the moon makes the most sense because it's got resources that you can make use of to build your city. Unlike Earth orbit, where literally every gram of that city would have to be launched into orbit, on the moon, you can make use of local materials, which is what they do. And I went through all the details of how you would go about building the city of Artemis and like what how it works and everything like that, and then why it exists. I went through this whole economic explanation of basically the price to low Earth orbit gets low enough that people can afford vacations into space. And another one was the economy of a city. It's like, why build a city anywhere? And it's like, okay, forget Artemis. Why does, like, you know, why does Piedmont exist?
Yeah.
You know, why does Pocatello, Idaho exist? And you'll find every single city that exists for some economic reason. It was initially founded for some reason. It was either a convenient place to set up a logging camp, or it's on a river and there's a natural like inlet that's a good place to build a port, or something. There's always some reason why the city is where it is and why people accumulated there. So for Artemis, I decided it's going to be tourism. Mm-hmm. They built it right next to the Apollo 11 landing site, and that's a thing that people think is cool and they're willing to travel to go see it. Okay. And so that's kind of where that is. Like, notice that entire explanation I gave you, there's not a single character or personality or human being involved in that. It's all just...
There's no Matt Damon in there. Yeah.
There's no... Yeah, well, or just that's where my stories start, is with the science.
Yeah.
And with Project Hail Mary, that was a little more complicated because it was a pastiche of a bunch of different story ideas I had. If anybody's listening to this and you haven't read Project Hail Mary yet, I don't know what to tell you. You're going to get some spoilers.
Yeah.
I always wanted to do a first contact story, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I start off with the scientific curiosity, and then I kind of say, like, okay, here's the neat thing. Now I need some characters to encounter the neat thing.
And we will be right back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I find your story so inspiring because you were a software engineer for 20 years?
Is that 25?
25 yeah. years. I love software engineers. We need them. Important part. And I know several. They aren't the people in my life that are prolific writers or creating characters. Very curious, wonderful people. So I was a little bit surprised when I learned that about you. Did writing start as a hobby? And tell me how you turned that into a full-time job.
Well, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer, like ever since I was a kid, ever since, I mean, I was writing, I think the first thing I ever wrote was a Henry and Ribsy fan fiction when I was six. Uh-huh. So Henry and Ribsy are the Beverly Cleary books for children about a boy and his dog. So I've always been writing stories when I was, you know, a tween. I would write short stories just in my notebook and stuff like that. And then just, so I was always writing. I was always like imagining stories and writing them. Usually science fiction, almost always, you know, about cool stuff going on in space. Yeah. Usually about a kid approximately my age having some sort of adventure, right? Yeah. And then when the time came, as I got older and now I'm like 18 and it's time for me to go to college, I honestly had to stop and think about like, do I want to be a professional author? But I'd been dicking around with computers and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was like, I could either go for and software engineering was really on the rise. This was 1990 when I turned 18 because I'm exceptionally old.
Hey.
We're getting there too.
We're just shortly behind.
I was born in the 1900s. Yeah. Software engineering was clearly becoming a new industry that was going to take off. And I mean, everyone knew it. And so I was like, well, I could either be a writer or I could be a computer programmer. It's time to go to college. I had to make up my mind. And I wanted to be a writer, but I also wanted regular meals.
Yeah.
So I decided to be a computer programmer. But writing was always my passion. Although, to be fair, I really enjoyed programming computers. I had fun. I liked that profession. I had a good time. But I was still writing as a hobby. What is it? Late 90s, I got laid off from America Online. And I had enough money from the severance package that I could go a couple of years without having to work. So I spent that time writing a book. And that book didn't get published. Couldn't find an agent, couldn't find a publisher interest, just no interest at all.
What was that like? Can I ask you? Because I read that in your
story. Usual tale of woe. It was like, it was half, oh man, I can't break in. This industry is so hard. And half, this book's not that good. You know,
okay.
I can kind of understand why, you know.
Well, because we'll work on something. We'll spend a day on it or 2 days on it. And then we'll watch it and be like, oh, it's not that good. And it pains us to hit the delete button. So, I mean, your book, it was a full, it was like 70,000 words or something like that. I mean, it was intense.
Well, The Martian, you mean?
No.
Your first book.
The first one.
The first one. Well, the very first one
that
no
didn't
one
get
knows
published.
About.
Oh, no. Oh.
Right. Oh. Yeah, the very first one I wrote, I was in college. It was called The Observer. And thank God I wrote that before the era of the internet. So it's just like
you can't
hard
find
copies. Yeah, it's not in any digital form anywhere. And it's awful.
Do you feel like you have to kind of let the sludge out? There's aspiring writers listening to this, you have to write some bad first books, bad first
drafts.
Well,
I wouldn't say that you have to, like, yeah. I wouldn't call it let the sludge out. I would just call it it's just like any other skill. You need to do it a bunch to get better at it. I don't think there's really any such thing as someone who's like a phenomenal author right out of the gate.
Got it.
Like, I wrote hundreds of thousands of words worth of short stories and two full-length novels and stuff before I even started The Martian. I mean, you have to suck for a long time before you stop sucking at something. And writing is no different than, like, woodworking or art. You know, you see those people who are, like, incredibly talented at art. If you looked at the early stuff they did, it would suck.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
I guess there are actually, like,
savants.
Naturally phenomenal. Yeah. Naturally phenomenal artists who could just kind of draw what they see perfectly. But that's rare.
Yeah.
Most artists have to get better, you know?
We have available on YouTube videos of Kim and I as news anchors in very, very small markets. And we look terrifying. Being held at gunpoint to talk about a basketball game or whatever it is that we're talking about. So I know I do subscribe to that Malcolm Gladwell, like, what is it, 10,000 hour thing.
Yeah, exactly. The Raptors today managed to end it on a 3-point buzzer shot.
How did you get access to his
Please
tape?
Let my daughter go. Yep.
Right. So he's a Raptors fan, being from probably having. I'm not sure why you're a Raptor. You're a Canadian.
I'm not. I picked a team at random.
Yeah. Okay. Go sports teams. I couldn't, like, if you put a gun to my head, I probably couldn't name three. You're fine.
I'm big into baseball. Like, baseball's my sport.
Baseball's your sport.
Love baseball. I like football. Basketball, I am utterly ignorant about. Like, so.
But you went with the Raptors.
That is, like, my. Yeah, I needed a team.
Is it
Illinois. I'm in the Chicago area right now. I guess I should have said the Bulls, but
well, they're not very good right now, so that's fine. So
I needed a team. I'm like, brain, quick.
Wait,
there's
good.
No time to explain.
Oh my gosh. So what just happened is a perfect segue to what I want to talk about next, because I want to know more about your brain, Andy. I do. I want to know more about your brain, because I do believe that you're writing. I'm fast forwarding through the tough years and into these books and this content that I've consumed, and it's extremely digestible for the neurodiverse community. And on this podcast, we talk about it a lot. I have ADHD. You can figure it out within 5 seconds of meeting me. My wife struggles, lives with, and in some cases conquers, but also succumbs to anxiety on occasion. And so we are two neurodiverse brains. And your books speak to, I think, me because of the problem solving, the challenging aspect of it that helps me follow it. But then on top of all of that, just this great sense of hope. And then most importantly, self-awareness in all of your main characters. There's a ton of self-awareness. So I want to know what your brain looks like.
I would classify myself as also kind of neurodiverse, although that's a kind of a new term. I've had a lifelong struggle with anxiety. And earlier in life, a serious problem with depression. I guess I'm more in the Kim camp. I don't have a problem with ADD or ADHD or anything like that, because I'm actually, I'm pretty good at concentrating on a single thing for a long time. Mm-hmm. In fact, I enjoy it. But for many years, in my early 20s, when I was in college, I went through a bout of, like, debilitating depression. Like, I had broken up with my girlfriend, and at the time I thought, oh, I'm just sad because of that. But it lasted for, like, a year and a half where I was like a non-functional human. I'm like, okay, like, this is not just whatever this is. It's not just because I broke up with my girlfriend. All right. Because like, this is, like,
too
so
much,
much worse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, I'm not even thinking about her. I'm just miserable now. You know, it was like 18 months of just, like, sleeping 15 hours a day and just you know, basically just being a non-functional human being. And so there was something chemical going on. I'm pretty sure I did eventually slowly come out of it. So I think it's like something like you reach a, I don't know the pharmacology, but like you the bad chemicals come and then they ebb away after a while when you're in your 20s, whatever. But regardless of that, I've had a lifelong problem with anxiety. And I know that chemical, the brain chemical wise, and I'm not a doctor, you know, but brain chemical wise, I know anxiety and depression are kind of two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. They go hand in hand. And oftentimes the medications that help with one will help with another. I've had anxiety issues since I was a kid, you know, like much more nervous and anxious about, you know, things that than is productive. What sucks is like I'm old enough that like when I was a teenager and a young adult, it was the 80s and 90s. And at the time there was an understanding that, okay, depression is a thing.
Yeah.
When they just invented like Prozac, right? And so the first of the, what's that category?
SSRIs.
Yeah. So that was like, they just started SSRI technology, but that was for depression. And so they go like, okay, that's cool. But for anxiety, generally, it was like, oh, what you need are some breathing exercises.
Correct.
Or suck it up and stop being such a is basically what I would get for anxiety advice.
Yeah. It was like, why would you have to be worried about? Like,
why are you worried? You know, it's like the Barney Stinson advice. Whenever I'm sad, I just don't be sad and I be awesome instead.
Yes.
Works every time.
Works, you know, every time.
But for anxiety, you know, I was going to group therapies. I was doing all these things. I've had the same therapist for 20 plus years.
Oh, wow.
And he's great. Basically, in days of yore, and he's good at getting to the root of problems and stuff like that. That's the psychological stuff. He's not a psychologist. He's not the kind that does medicines.
Psychiatrists do medicine. Psychologists do the talk therapy.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever.
He's a therapist, right? Yeah. But anyway, for so long, it was always just like, oh, here's some breathing exercises you can do to calm it down. I'm like, that's like throwing a bucket of water on a forest fire. It's like, okay, no, that doesn't help. It doesn't help. I'm still like stay up all night, like, or it's the kind of thing. And I'm really glad to be on this show because mental health awareness is like my pet issue, so to speak. This is what I always want to talk about. And I always have my spiel that I want to say is like to whomever is listening, although I'm sure your listeners have all heard this before, but to whomever is listening, if you have a mental health issue, be it depression or anxiety or something else, you cannot solve it by yourself any more than if you broke your leg and you try to solve that by yourself.
Right.
Okay. You need medical professionals to help you with it. You need some sort of intervention from a third party to help you with this problem. Mm-hmm. And just as if you'd broken like your femur, you need immediate help and then you need to do the therapy. Mm-hmm. In the femur case, it's physical therapy. In the mental case, it's therapy. But you have to do that, and it's work and it's annoying. But there's a real, you know, there's a lot of stigma about mental health issues. And people are like, if you break your leg, everyone immediately understands, oh, yeah, I get it. I understand why you can't walk. You broke your leg. And it's like, but if you're suffering from like a clinical depression, people don't understand. It's like, why can't you get out of bed?
Right.
It's like, you've got muscles, you're healthy, get out of bed.
Yeah.
But
because people can see the cast and they can't see the other stuff.
Well, they can also immediately understand the concept of like pain and a body part not working.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because everyone in the world has had that happen. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily breaking a leg, but everyone in the world has been physically harmed at some point or not been able to use part of their body because it's really sore or got hurt. Like, everyone has experienced that, but not everyone has experienced debilitating depression or anxiety. Finally, what happened was, this ties into my really, you say neurodivergent, I would say like probability divergent lifestyle, where I ended up like, so after The Martian was popular, it was being made into a movie. I got invited to NASA. I got invited to JSC, Johnson Space Center in Houston. I lived in California at the time, and I had a debilitating fear of flying as part of my anxiety issues. So I said, like, I have got to do this. I have a chance to go spend a week getting VIP tours at Johnson Space Center. And they're just thrilled to have me there because they loved The Martian. And I'm like, I have got to go there. Mm-hmm. So I went to my doctor and I said, I need to be able to fly. I have a
give me all you got, doc.
Give me whatever you got. Give me an in-flight anesthesiologist. I don't care.
Yes.
I need to be able to fly. And she referred me to a psychiatrist, and that psychiatrist, not to be confused with the therapist, said like, okay, well, let's talk. And I'm like, we don't need to talk. You need to give me pills that knock me on my ass.
Cart me onto the wheelchair.
I'm going to have people with me to take care of me. I'm going to have my parents will be with me to kind of pour me into the seat and then pull me out of the plane. Like, I'll have people to take care of me. I don't need to be self functioning. Yeah. I'm not going to drive. Just give me something that will knock me on my ass. And she's like, okay, take a breath. We'll do that. But I want to talk to you about understanding what's going on in your brain. And so, which is great because she did. And she said like, okay, I think you have like general anxiety disorder. And I think you should try these long-term medications. Right. And also, here's Valium to get you on the plane.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's the thing that knocks you on your ass that you requested. There you go. That takes care of the immediate problem. But I think you should be taking these other pills long term.
So,
and I'm still taking them. And it's weird. It's I don't know if you're taking anything, Kim, but it dramatically improved my life, but it did so slowly that I didn't notice. Like, so it's so slow. The it's just a gradual improvement over time. And I'm still more anxious than the average person. But things that used to just put me into an absolute tizzy are now just like things that are like annoying.
Well, okay. And then, okay, here's my journey with the meds. So in the 90s, I was in college. It was the first time on the Prozacs. And that helped a lot until it didn't. And then it just stopped working. And then I kind of was like, and it's also one of those things where like, I don't need it anymore. I'm cured. I'm fine because you're taking the medicine.
That's the worst mistake.
I know. So I got off and because I was like, I don't need it.
I'm healed.
And I'm all better now.
I'm all better
now. That's when you find out that you can't just
stop. So I did for many years after my second child was born, had really scary postpartum.
Even better.
Yes, I mixed so even like better. You have like hormones. Yeah.
So that plus postpartum stuff. Oh, like
the postpartum anxiety was so bad that I couldn't walk while carrying my baby. I would like go down the stairs on my butt because I was like, I just had these really bad intrusive thoughts. I couldn't drive. It was terrible. So I got back on meds then and I stayed on them for about 9 years. And then I did the thing again where I'm like, I am healed.
I'm fine.
And so I've been sort of on and off, but my issue with the meds, and Penn was on ADHD meds for a while, but because we write a lot of comedy and we write these goofy songs and sketches and
it does take the edge off.
It takes the edge off in a way that it made my brain feel a little bit like cotton candy. So I am not opposed to medicine. In fact, I think I definitely need some, but I need to have patience and grace of giving my body time to experiment with something else because there's been changes since I've been on them recently. Because I don't, and I'm curious, like, do you feel as
creative?
It's like my creativity used to be like a really spiky thing with lots of sharp edges, and now those edges are a little duller, you know, but it's still there.
Okay.
But I just had to make the decision that my mental health is more important. So it just means I need to work harder at my writing. I would rather work harder at writing to get the same results as before than be miserable all the time.
Yeah, that's some truth
so
right there.
Do you mind if I ask? So when you wrote Project Hail Mary, were you on these meds?
Yeah.
Then you have nothing to worry about.
And also Artemis.
Yeah. Okay, you have nothing to worry about.
You're fine. You're cured.
Thank you. I'm cured. I guess I can stop.
No, don't ever stop.
Well, I'll tell you. No, I never stop. Well, I will tell you one thing. Like, so my wife and I had a baby.
Congratulations.
Thank you. He's my everything. He's my little man. He's 21 months old now, coming on 22 months. So a little long in the tooth to be starting the game, but I've wanted to be a dad ever since I was in my 20s. That's the thing I've always known that I wanted to do. Just took me a long time to find a woman who will put up with my shit. And you need a woman to make babies. I looked it up. So,
yeah,
that's your next book.
Yeah,
that's my. Yeah. We have a baby, and of course, having a baby, as you both know, it just completely screws with your sleep schedule, your everything. And I ended up just by accident just missing my meds like three nights in a row.
Ooh.
Like, so I take them. I even have an alarm to remind me to take them on my phone. Okay, take your meds. It's just once a day. You know, I take them usually at night. And just for whatever reason, I had failed to take them for three nights in a row and not really noticed. It's just been so busy with the baby. And we had a dog that also had some health problems. And at the time, I was just like, I was dizzy and I was like unfocused. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I just felt like I felt like vertigo. I was just like, oh, what the hell? And then I was out walking the dog and I just started to like go into this state of like panic and crying for like no reason. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And like, I'm like, I don't even think I can drive because of these dizzy spells. And Ashley's like, that's my wife. She's like, well, you have to call your doctor. You have to find out what's going on. And I called my doctor and she's like, taking your meds?
Oh, that's all she said?
Well, yeah, of course.
Actually.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's like the computer support guy.
I've missed like the last 3 days of my meds. She's like, okay, just get back on them. Don't take more. Don't try to make up for the missed time. Just resume your meds.
So Ashley sounds like she has become a little bit of that trained professional when you break your femur.
This was my doctor who told me.
Oh,
that.
Sorry.
Ashley.
So
Ashley is my wife, and right. And she said, call your doctor.
Right. Okay.
There's something wrong.
But to that point, I guess to that point, I want to talk about the relationship that you have with your wife and that she has with your neurodiversity, because we talk about this a lot. How important is it to partner with someone and to be as honest as possible with what's going on with your brain to make that relationship work?
When we were dating, I explained all this stuff to her. Like, I mean, so she knew what she was getting into.
Yeah. I mean, we all have our own stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, as someone who has walked with anxiety and, you know, you're putting out these really, I would imagine, we published a book, but it's in the nonfiction space, and it was very anxiety inducing to know that people would read about words that I wrote. Something about creating a video on the internet, I don't know, you scroll past it, it kind of disappears, but a book, people can read it and they can hold it and touch it and see it, and it just felt so vulnerable to me.
And they can talk about it and tell you how much it sucks.
Right. So what is that like, hitting, you know, publish on a not hitting publish. You don't hit publish.
Well, yeah.
It's published. On it. When it goes into stores, like, what is that anxiety like? How do you deal with that?
Tremendous.
Yeah.
You know?
It's
extremely nerve-wracking. Now, obviously, The Martian had this overwhelmingly positive response. That was very validating for me. It made me feel very good about myself. But yeah, it's scary. And, you know, I can read 1,000 positive reviews of one of my books and one negative review.
You're describing my wife.
Yeah.
And I'll just be like,
crushed. You're like, I shouldn't do this anymore. They're right.
Yeah, right.
They're right.
Clearly,
they're onto something.
Oh, and I've got imposter syndrome coming out of every aura of my body.
Wait a second. Yeah. You have imposter syndrome?
Of course.
What?
Please talk more about that.
Please tell me how.
So let's see. I wrote The Martian, and it out of nowhere is a hit. And I'm like, okay, I don't know why this book, which is basically a long string of algebra word problems, became popular. I don't know what I did right. The character also, while he cracks jokes, has zero depth. Like, all the things you're supposed to do in a book, I didn't do, right? Like, Mark Watney is the same person at the end of the book as he was at the beginning. He undergoes no growth, no change, nothing. And also, he has no depth. You don't know anything about him. After reading the entire book, all you know about Mark Watney is he's smart, he's pretty brave, didn't want to die. That's it.
No, he loved Iron Man.
He
hated 1980s disco music.
We knew a lot of what he didn't like.
70s, yeah.
70s. Sorry, 1970s.
Yeah, we knew something. Yeah, but like superficial things. Like, you don't know if he had like a woman waiting for him back home or a man. Oh, you don't know anything about him.
So, okay. Now that you bring it up, you're right.
Yeah,
but it still was amazing.
Yeah.
No, I didn't need to. So the thing is, I'm a very, very plot-driven author, much less character-driven. But I do consider that a weakness in my writing, that my characters are very flat and two-dimensional. And so I'm always working on that because I think like, hey, people like my plots. Imagine if I had deep and complex characters to go along with that, how much better my stuff would be, right?
Ken has raised his hand.
Yeah,
right
I'm going to retort, okay. Dude. I'm sorry. And look, we deal with imposter syndrome all the time. We don't understand why people like us. quite a bit.
You're just both pretty hot, I think. That's what it comes down to.
I'm just going to play it over and over again.
You're both just like hot. I mean, once again,
I'm gonna put you
on that list, Penn, with
you're on the list.
All right.
Okay.
Well, okay, let me keep before I pass out from this feeling that I'm having right now.
In his bathing suit area.
My private parts. I really do think, Andy, like, and I want to talk about the
make
most recent.
Me feel yeah, funny exactly. when my bathing suit covers.
you wrote an alien into existence in Project Hail Mary that I think is one of the most it's definitely the most dynamic alien that I've ever read about, and I think it's one of the most dynamic characters. And I also have a theory that, and his name's Rocky, he looks like a giant tarantula is the best way to explain him. But
yep.
I believe that he had ADHD, like the good kind. Like I believe
I know that you've seen ADHD. You mentioned that in the emails as we were getting set up. It's funny you should mention that. I had a concept for Rocky. Of course, Iridian, that's his species, for those who haven't read the book. Iridians are a completely alien species. They evolved from the ground up on another planet. They're not, well, we later find out they are extraordinarily distantly related to us in that Earth and their home world were both seeded with life by a panspermia event 4 billion years ago. But
oh my gosh, Penn is like jumping up and down right now for those listening. And I'm like, yes, I kind of got it totally. Done. Okay. I'm following. I'm tracking. Go.
Yeah. Evolved from the ground up. So their brains don't necessarily have to have any correlation to how our brains work. How they work, like they would have evolved to deal with their environment. We evolved to deal with ours, right? It's interesting you say he has ADHD because in a way he does. I deliberately intended for Iridians to be they are much better at multitasking than humans are. So I had already decided that they have a difficult time concentrating on a single thing because they are used to doing multiple things at once. And this all comes from the fact that they have a 360-degree perception of their environment and 5 independent limbs that are all as nimble as your dominant hand. And so they can have a conversation with you while also concentrating on doing a task, and the one thing doesn't take from the other thing's concentration. I was actually thinking of like if I ever wrote a sequel, like that Iridians, when interacting with each other, can have multiple conversations simultaneously. Like, so these two Iridians will be talking about 2 or 3 things at the same time. So they'll be maintaining multiple conversation threads.
That makes my armpit sweat even just thinking about it. My anxiety cannot.
And so, you know, I was gonna do the conversations. I was gonna split into two columns in the text so that they're having these conversations at the same time, and then maybe they link up, you know,
somewhere.
So if you imagine just like Rocky and his mate Adrian, you know, are just talking about just a normal day, not even like anything big or important. It's like, you know, they would have one conversation. It's like, what do you want to do for dinner tonight? And also, oh, we need to fix the, you know, we need to fix this wall in the house. So, okay, well, yeah, so I was thinking we might do this for dinner. Oh, yeah. And also, we're going to need to get some supplies to fix the wall. And, you know, just imagine the mundane conversations you two have as a couple just going through your lives and having multiple of them at the same time. And that's completely normal.
So you're describing my family's dinner table.
I was going to say, also, I feel like this is the influence of you having a toddler at the house. Because... No.
Well, I finished Project Hail Mary before our baby was born.
Okay.
In fact, by some coincidence, the book, you know, Project Hail Mary came out about 3 weeks before he did.
Oh. So what is that like then? I mean, how does having this little guy around, first of all, I really hate it when they ask, like, how do you balance it all, like, to working moms, as if, like, there aren't dads? Yeah. Like, why aren't we asking that to dads? But as I'm assuming you need to be pretty dialed into a project to make things work, how does having, like, how does a toddler around change that process?
Well, one thing that helps, and I recommend this to anybody, is to have a whole lot of money.
Highly recommend.
So I really recommend having like a lot of money. So I don't, you know, I don't know why, you know, so basically stop being poor. So in short, we have a nanny. Yeah. So like we have a nanny that helps take care of our baby all day long. We don't just like, you know, screw off and we're
you're active parents. Of course.
Yeah, we're active parents.
But you have a job and this is your job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So my wife takes care of the nanny is the bulk of the caretaking of our toddler during the day. My wife is involved, like, you know, she's making his meals. She's doing that. Yeah. Like the nanny would do that, but my wife just wants to do that.
Yeah.
Right. And then they call me in for backup when needed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I work from home. I have a home office. And so they'll be like, okay, we had a poop. Need your help chase that.
It's three alarm poop.
Yep. We had a blowout or it's bath time. It kind of takes all three of us to give them a bath.
Oh my God.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you said you have kids, right?
We have kids. We have a 16-year-old girl and a 13-year-old boy.
Whole new world.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, at least with them, they probably actively avoid you. So that makes it a little easier, right?
I will say my advice, not advice, but my sort of word of warning to people with toddlers is, first of all, it's a lovely, crazy time. It was such a blur, especially with what was happening with my mental health. But I would say as much as you think they need you as a toddler, they need you more as teens.
Yeah.
But it just happens in such condensed moments because they're at school and then, you know, my daughter has a track meet. So I'll go to watch her track meet, but I won't see her till 7. But when I'm in the car with her from 7 to 7:15 and then sitting with her at dinner from 7:15 to 7:45 and then she's up in her room studying or whatever. But those like 45 minutes, a lot of parenting. It's like very intense. Good. It's good.
Oh, and it's not just what you say. It's how you say it.
Yeah.
There are layers of complexity, but I wouldn't trade, honestly, like I wouldn't trade this.
The teens
stage
are my
favorite. Yeah. It's fantastic. You're like, anyone who tells you, well, good luck when they go through puberty, man, just going to, you know, get a shotgun on your porch for your daughter or whatever. Like don't subscribe to any of that.
Mine's a boy. So
you're good.
Well, yeah, I just need to worry about wrecking the car,
right,
kind of thing.
Different, yeah.
Well, boys are
have a boy, right?
Yeah, are so, yeah. So different. And he's, you know, 13. And then he was like during the pandemic, it, like hit during a weird developmental time. So, but that too is like, I feel like we're just like on the record more because I can remember being 13 and remember like the weirdness of being 13.
That sucks to be like go from age 11 to 13 during the pandemic.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Basically, it's like, tough. Hey, I really like girls. Well, you can't see any.
You can't. I know. And so developmentally, I feel as if our kids are kind of 2 years behind socially. All kids.
Yeah.
Like all kids. Anyway.
Fortunately for us, our baby was born during the pandemic. So
you're at home anyway.
You know, it's not going to, yeah, he's home all the time anyway. We were stuck in the house with him anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The one thing that did suck, and this is just purely emotional, so it's just, it doesn't matter that much, but like, I couldn't go to the ultrasounds with my wife.
Oh,
like,
that does suck.
Yeah, they wouldn't let
really?
Me.
It, yeah.
Yeah, so at that time, it was the height of the pandemic, so it's like, the patient goes in and sees a doctor, but you can't, you know, bring your husband with you. And were so you... I didn't get to see the ultrasounds as they have. I mean, she would come out and bring me the little printouts of the pictures, yeah, and stuff like that, which is cool. But I didn't get to see, yeah, the live feed.
But you were able to be in the room when he was born.
Yes. By that, even during the pandemic, they would let husbands into the delivery room.
I feel like there was a few weeks where they didn't. I feel like I heard that was very early days. That was like, yeah.
Well, as a woman who's had given birth twice, I'm sure you know it's all about the well-being of the mom, mm-hmm, and also keeping her calm. My whole job there was to, you know, hold her hand and, mm, you know, kind of be there as moral support. But the weirdest thing for me was, and I'm sure you, Penn, probably you went through this too, is like, she has the baby. They immediately take him away. They give him like a vitamin B shot because he was premature, and or vitamin K, or vitamin, yeah, something.
Yeah.
Whatever.
A vitamin. Yes.
A vitamin and then a steroid shot to make sure that his lungs develop, yeah, well, because he was a bit of a preemie. And also I want to start getting that batting average up early. And then they, you know, they get him all cleaned up and everything like that. They wrap him up in a blanket. They hand him to me and then they cart my wife off and they send me into the hall. And I'm like,
where is he?
Here I am.
Okay, now it's just me. Yeah.
And a baby.
And this newborn. This seems really irresponsible of you.
Yeah.
To do this, to just hand me a baby and then run away.
What was the baby's response?
At first, he was like screaming.
Mm-hmm.
But then once they, you know, finished all their hassling of him and wrapped him up, he's just, you know, he's a larva.
He's
just like,
yeah. Well, there's that, yeah, swaddle that basically, and they're like, yeah, oh, it just makes, yeah, him feel safe. But really, it's just, yeah, a straitjacket. Like,
yeah,
with the baby's like, aww, this.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a little baby burrito, and, yeah, I'm just like holding him, and I'm like, okay.
I do remember that first night in the hospital with our first child. Like, you're just going to leave her here with us? You know,
yeah,
like, are you sure? I'm like, is there a test you need us to take? Because I'm not sure I would pass it. It was horrifying. It was so, we had no idea what we were doing.
I need a license to drive a car,
yes,
but to unleash a human on society, nothing.
Nothing. I know. I feel like Lola loves it. I mean, we've stopped calling her this, but we call her a lot like the first pancake. Cause you know, the first pancake, yeah, is always like, you know,
that's how I describe my first book. Yeah. The one that no one's seen.
The first pancake. Okay. So Lola was the first pancake. So by number two, we were like, okay, we know sort of how to make a baby stop crying.
I'm sure that Lola really appreciates that.
And
I'm sure Lola's like, oh,
I'm the,
yeah,
hero.
No, I'm the one you made. I'm the one that you consider to be the completely, you know,
no,
I don't think, up, yeah, one that you did everything wrong on.
I'll be honest. I don't think she cares. I think she just wants to be the first.
Yeah. She's,
I think she, yeah, she wears that around like a badge, being the big sister.
She's like high. Yeah. She's very typical high achieving firstborn. So yeah,
she wants to remind your son of the importance of primogeniture.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yes.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of a good way to segue out of this. I think I got one.
Okay. Got it.
It's pretty bad. It's actually pretty bad.
Let's hear it.
Okay.
We can't wait to hear what's next with you in your parenting journey. We'd also love to know what's next with you in your writing.
What are you working on?
I know. We're a bunch of parents talking about kids that'll last all day, right?
Yeah.
So the baby, I basically took a couple of years off from doing anything because taking care of a baby.
Yeah.
I'm back to it now. So for me, I'm in that phase where I have an idea. I'm working it. I've got about 10,000 words in, and I'm in that part of the project where I'm like, well, I think this might suck, and I don't know, and I'm going to need to just keep working it for a while. But yeah, I'm feeling insecure about it. Everybody and their dog wants me to write a Project Hail Mary sequel. I understand that. Okay, so The Martian is unsequelable. You
right.
can't make
yeah.
a sequel to that. It's like, oh, can you believe this guy's luck? Now he's stuck on Venus. You know, no,
yeah.
it doesn't work. And Artemis didn't. I mean, actually, it sold very well, but it's not the thing that I'm known for. And I did actually pitch an idea for a sequel to Artemis. And my editor's like,
Don't you love that?
Project Hail Mary. Now there is a thing that
Ryan Gosling. Yeah,
Ryan Gosling.
If you're feeling sequel-y.
First of all, I love that you said the word unsequelable.
Yeah.
And I do want to explain just to the listeners who have not read Project Hail Mary, but it does end with what could be potentially another adventure.
Yeah, you could. So Project Hail Mary is very sequelable.
Yeah.
Except for I can't quite get all the moving parts together the way I want. So a lot of people say like, hey, I'd really love a story about what was going on Earth while Grace and Rocky were doing their stuff. And I'm like, okay, the problem is like, if I wrote a sequel to Project Hail Mary that didn't have Rocky in it, they'd be like at my door with pitchforks and.
So yes. I, as advice to aspiring writers, I just want people to hear that there's a part in every project, but I would imagine more it's exacerbated on the pages of a book. There's a part where you're doubting everything and you think it sucks, right?
Yes. So if I may name drop a bit, so I was in Albuquerque to shoot a pilot for a TV show that never got picked up. Mm-hmm. But I hung out a lot with George R. R. Martin because he lives in Santa Fe.
Wow.
Right. So it was fun hanging out with George. And I saw him as something of a mentor, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was talking to him and I was like, and he's like, how's it going? And at that point, I was just, I think at that point, I was working on Artemis. And I'm like, well, you know, The Martian went great and I'm working on my next book, but I just kind of feel like that I actually suck and that like I've written my last good book and that they're all going to suck from now on. And he's like, well, if it makes you feel any better, that never goes away.
And so yes,
if
it
you
makes
write
you feel
20
better.
Chart-topping hits in a row, when you're working on your 21st one, you'll be like, this is the one that's going to ruin me.
It's oddly comforting, but also terrifying.
And coming from George R. R. Martin, I love hearing that from him because I think anyone who either reads or watches Game of Thrones remembers that there was this like rabid appetite for it where everyone was just staring at him like, right faster. I think Weird Al did like a parody and an award show like, right faster. And I can't imagine that pressure for anybody. So it sounds like you're saying that I don't know that you're in that right now, but you kind of are.
Well, I don't really have yes, fans are like, oh man, I want you to hurry up and write another book. I'm thrilled, but it's not like the sort of hassling that George would get, right?
Right.
Because they're obsessed with a story that is not finished. And
exactly.
They're like, we want to see how this ends. Whereas for me, people are like, I like your writing. I'm looking forward to the next thing. Hurry up and make it happen.
Yeah. So, question we often ask our guests, do you have a favorite karaoke song? Do you karaoke? Are you karaoke?
I mean, I sing along with songs on the radio. I don't go out of my way to karaoke. I do like singing. My wife doesn't like my singing. So I've noticed something about myself that I thought everybody had, but I guess just me or another. There is almost always a song in my head.
Oh.
There's almost always background music going on in my head. And it'll be based on some visual clue or something like that I saw, or a sequence of notes I heard from something else, or a conversation I had. It'll be something will seed a song in my head, in my head. And like, you know.
Are you sure you don't have ADHD, or at least like a little bit?
I don't know,
of
but
it?
there's always like a background music track going on in my head. Really? At any given moment, you can usually ask me what it is. And this is a sad story, but like many years ago, my cat died. It was not unexpected. He was very, very ill. He was 17 years old. We all have that one pet that's the special one that's like stands out above the end. He was that pet, and I was like holding him in my arms, and I knew I was gonna have to take him to put him down, and the music stopped, and that was like I would consciously aware for the first time in God knows how long that there wasn't background music in my head.
Do you have pen? Do you have background music?
Yes.
I've never heard this before.
So Andy, mine is not an actual song that's been written. It's something that hasn't been most of the time. It's usually something, a lot of times it's just something that's noodling, just notes. But sometimes it's one that I am thinking about.
For me, it's usually just like if I'm driving, I'll usually have my radio on, then whatever song was playing when I stopped the car will run through my head. But then I'll like see something that'll make me, I'll glance up, I'll see this chandelier, and I'll be thinking of Sia's chandelier until something else.
And that's just in your brain as you're talking to people, as you're
kind
going.
Of. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, right now, if you're curious, it's Please Please Me by the Beatles.
Ah.
Because earlier on, my wife is like, oh, I got to do this thing. Can you please, please go and take care of this other thing? And so since then, it's been Please Please Me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. I am fascinated by this. I've never heard this before. And I did. I guess I could, because Penn is a musician. I guess I could assume that would make perfect sense that you would have music in your head. I more think of his brain that it just looks like the Looney Tunes, just like cartoon characters.
You guys are all just a bunch of Muppets.
Yes, that we are like fuzzy hair and have purple skin.
You see
skin.
Us the way that, what was it, that Abed sees people? Is that what it was? Or who was it where
Kenneth,
there was a show?
Kenneth and 30 Rock. I don't know if you watched
Kenneth
30 Rock.
And 30 Rock, yes. Yeah. I remember there was a scene where you saw...
Well, I think you're awfully special, Kenneth. Yeah. That's our second super random pop reference that we've made together, Andy and I. The first one was the Underground Sugar Caves. And the second one is Kenneth from 30
and
Rock.
Now
I think we should get an apartment together.
The immortal intern.
And now you're going to get an apartment together. And I'll touch base with Ashley. We'll figure out childcare.
Right.
I do want to say, like, you definitely, Kim said beforehand, she's like, are you nervous about meeting your hero? Because there are those horror stories where you meet the hero and they suck.
Hitler was okay, I guess.
He built some good roads. No,
I want to talk to you. I want to spend the rest of this interview talking about who really did 9/11. Let me tell you, it's an ethnicity, and it's not the one you.
And there we go. He is terrible, you guys.
And he's awful.
And he is terrible.
But it is interesting because you never know.
As suspected.
You never know, even for anyone who's listening who isn't me, that just like you look at the authors on a jacket cover, and they're always like they have like a look about themselves where you feel like they're going to say like that's going to be the first thing that they say.
Hi, Andy, pleasure to meet you.
Yeah. Just something I don't know. You're definitely not that person. You're pretty friendly. And it's so funny because
thank you.
You have this, you admitted to having this imposter syndrome because as you broke down for us, like all of your stories are kind of science based, but you inject so much of your personality, whether that's through struggles that you had or through sad times or good times or just self-awareness or self-deprecation in every character that you have. And that's what gives it the depth, in my opinion.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, that self-deprecation is, you know, my own feelings of inadequacy. I think one of the things that, you know, it's weird, like in Hollywood circles, I have a reputation as being very easy to work with. I think that's just because I'm a normal person. And I think I owe that to having success come so late in life. Like I was in my mid 40s or so when The Martian, you know, hit it big. And so I had 45 years or so of life making sure I understood that I was just, you know, some guy.
Yeah. Right? You didn't experience, to your point, like all it helps to have a lot of money. You didn't have that until late in life. So,
right. Yeah. I grew up poor. Like parents changed their phone number frequently to avoid creditors. And we were very poor when I was a kid.
I mean, I think that is probably why you're easy to work with and easy to talk to. Don't you think?
I don't know. I have lived in the real world, I guess you could say. My therapist says anxiety is basically OCD. But instead of trying to control everything in your environment, you're trying to control the future. So it's OCD about time.
Ah.
It's like You're like, so a person with OCD might be like, I need the kitchen to be completely clean. And if even somebody so much as touches a doorknob, I have to go clean the doorknob. It's like you have to have complete and total control over your physical environment if you have OCD.
Yeah.
Well, anxiety is just OCD about your future. You have to have complete and total control over your future, which means you sit there planning, over planning, spending way too much time thinking about what do I do if this happens? What do I do if this happens? Worrying about this, worrying about that, trying to make sure you have every possible case covered. And of course, there is no way to do that.
But if I worry about it enough, then I'm prepared for every scenario, Andy.
Right. Yes. That's the flawed logic that that accompanies anxiety. And yeah, and so it really sucks. And of course, the people who, such as myself, who have that problem, who overplan and go crazy on that stuff, are the least equipped emotionally to handle it when things do go awry.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So you're like, you planned for every scenario, but you didn't account for this one thing. And then that one thing happens. And then you're like, oh my God, now what? It's the equivalent of, you know, someone with OCD and someone just goes and throws a bunch of tar in the middle of their living room. You know, it's like,
no, it's a really good analogy and does kind of wrap up how my brain works for sure. Mm.
Okay. It has been an hour and 10 minutes. I would have been happy for 5 minutes. Thank you for giving us so much of your time, Andy.
Oh my
We're really
gosh.
Grateful.
And I will, I'll send you links of apartments and we'll work this out. We'll work out visitation.
We'll work out visitation.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been a joy. Fair. Thank you so much
Thanks for having me.
No, but just for being so honest about your process. It's a very inspiring story because your success happened late in life. So thank you.
Well, I would say one other thing I would say to anyone, since your focus is on kind of neurodivergence, is Carrie Fisher was a big inspiration to me. We were going to be at the same convention. And I always get to be in the green room, you know, so I was really looking forward to meeting her. And she passed away about 3 weeks before that happened. I really wish I could have met her because I would have thanked her for her book. She wrote a book called Wishful Drinking, which I recommend to everyone. And it's about her struggles with bipolar disorder and it's about her life and stuff like that. And when I read that, it made me go like, wow, she had it much worse than I do. Mm-hmm. And she was successful. So... Yeah. It's not a death sentence to your productivity or to your ability to accomplish things in life to have these problems.
Wow. That's so really, yeah.
To any of your listeners who feel a certain level of hopelessness for being neurodivergent, I would recommend they read that book. It's called Wishful Drinking. It's by Carrie Fisher.
I'm gonna add it to cart right now. Thank you. That was Andy Weir. Penn, how are you feeling?
I think you did a better job interviewing him than I did because I wanted to like blurt out. Yeah. But like, do you remember the SNL skit when Chris Farley is interviewing Paul McCartney?
Yes.
And all he wants to be is like, you remember when you said the love you take is easier than the love you make? That was pretty cool. So I felt a little bit like Chris Farley. So I'm glad you were there. My prediction came true. You guys had this like great connection and you have a ton in common. And I actually just enjoyed watching that. He's a cool dude. Like he's not
so cool.
He's like, I'm glad I met my hero.
Yes.
The fact, okay. We didn't have this recording afterwards.
We hit stop.
Yeah. And we were like,
and
it was
we just
nice.
Chit-chatted.
Yeah. And we're like, it was nice to meet you, Andy. And he says back to us with a total straight face, it was nice to meet you too. Discount Kelly and Ryan.
It was the funniest, best compliment. We are the dupe version of Kelly and Ryan.
Not even dupe. Dupe is one thing. Discount is a stretch lower, and it was a very good burn.
Hilarious.
Very good burn.
But he was, you know, I loved, you don't want anybody to struggle. I don't want anybody to struggle. But there's some sort of odd comfort in knowing this person who has experienced critical and commercial success struggles with the creative process. So I found it oddly inspiring.
I think everyone will.
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't everybody, And I don't know about everybody. I do know a lot of people who want to write books or stories or even start making videos on the internet, or and just the getting started is there's this fear of everything, right? And even the best feel that way, not only back in the day, but right now. Yeah. Like he's dealing with that right now.
It's fascinating. Anyway, you guys, if you made it to the end of this podcast, you know what to do. You send us a screenshot. You hit me up on Instagram. You send us a message and tag us because I love to reply to those messages. And so many of you do. And I love you for it. So anyway, I hope you guys have a good day. I love you. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.